Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcasts, brought to you by Circle Sanctuary, one of the oldest nature spirituality churches in the United States, connecting people of nature-centered paths around the world. Join us through the week for a variety of shows discussing various topics, celebrating the divine in all of its forms through nature worship, rituals, education, and building bridges of community. Now, welcome to Circle Talk Radio, a production of Circle Sanctuary's Radio Ministries program. Tonight's episode of Circle Talk is an encore presentation from 2018, where Circle Sanctuary Minister Deborah Rose was joined by Ellen Hopman to discuss tree medicine and tree magic.
Welcome to our show. My name is Deborah Rose, and I'm your host on Circle Talk. Tonight, we will be talking with author Ellen Hopman. Ellen is the author of at least 13 books and has been a teacher of herbalism since 1983 and of druidism since 1990. She has presented on druidism, herbal lore, tree lore, paganism, and magic at conferences, festivals, events in Northern Ireland, Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the United States. She is a master herbalist and a professional member of the American Herbalist Guild, the AHG. And lay homeopath who holds a master's in education and mental health counseling. She is a founding member of the Order of the White Oak and its former co-chief. She is currently Archdruid of the Tribe of the Oak, an international druid teaching order based in New England. Her recent book is a second edition of her first book, Tree Medicine and Tree Magic, and has been updated and revised, and we're going to talk about that. Ellen also has a book coming out called The Real Witches of New England, History, Lore, and Modern Practice. Besides having written over 10 nonfiction books, I think I have most of them, and I think there's 13, has also written three Iron Age Celtic fiction novels, Priestess of the Forest, A Druid Journey, The Druid Isle, and Priestess of the Fire Temple, A Druid's Tale. Ellen writes from the pagan perspective with strong female lead characters to explore the initial encounters between the indigenous druids and incoming Christian missionaries in Ireland and Scotland. This series may become a movie, so we'll be talking to her about that too. Please visit her bookstore and blog at www.ellenevretthopman.com. And we'll have that on our chat. It's ELLENEVERTHOPMAN.com. We've got lots to talk about tonight, so let's meet Ellen. Welcome, Ellen.
Hey, very nice to be here. Thank you.
It has been a couple years since you've been on. You've been busy.
Yeah, I seem to be crazy that way. I just finished another book, besides the witch book. I just finished another one, and I just started the next one.
What's the book I don't know about that you've finished?
The one that I just finished is The Herbs and Spirits of Samhain. So it's all about the Samhain festival, but I go into a lot of different herbs to contact the spirits. So I use Egyptian. There's Egyptian magic in there. There's a lot of Celtic stuff. There's Polish stuff, you know. But it's basically and the one that I'm doing now is Beltane, you know. So it's one book is the herbs and spirits of Samhain, and the next one is the herbs and spirits of Beltane, because those are the two. From what I can tell, those are the two biggest, most important festivals, because one starts the light half of the year, the other one starts the dark half of the year, you know, the portals between the seasons, kind of.
Absolutely. Have you always, have you written since you were small? Have you always, because you're a real prolific writer and you're a very good writer.
Yeah, no. No, I was never a writer. I never thought I would be a writer. I never studied to be a writer. I was not an English major. I didn't know anything about it. I was studying counseling, mental health counseling at the University of Massachusetts. And when I moved here, I used to live in Philadelphia. I moved up to Massachusetts, and the growing season was so short here. It just, you know, because I was already an herbalist. I was very plant-oriented. And it just shocked me because the frost started in September, and you couldn't plant anything until after Memorial Day. And that, so,
I mean, that's not very long.
Right. So I was trying to figure out, I was trying to imagine, I guess this is the way my mind works. I'm always thinking in terms of ancient times. I feel like I'm an Iron Age druid, you know, living in the 21st century. That's really what I am. Because I was looking out the window thinking, how are you supposed to live in the winter when there's no nothing to eat? That's literally what I was thinking. You know, there's a grocery store you can go to, but I just couldn't figure it out. And so then I looked out the window, and everywhere I looked, I saw trees. And I said, the trees are there all winter. That must have something to do with it. So I went to the library, and I started looking for a book that would show me how to eat trees and make, you know, anyway, and make medicine out of trees and so on. And I couldn't find one. They didn't exist. And tree medicine, tree magic, as far as I know, is really the first pagan tree, magical tree book that came out. It came out in the 80s. And a lot of books have come out since then, you know. But I literally, there I was a grad student. I was studying counseling. And I said, well, gosh, there isn't any book. I guess I have to write one. And and I happened to be working, you know, as a student, I was also working at the library at UMass and shelving books. That was my job, right? So I noticed that as I was pushing my Carol along and shelving the books, I kept seeing tree books. And I thought, this is interesting.
And it was fun. Fun.
Yeah, it's like they were literally jumping at me. They were saying, here I am, you know. And so all I did was on my breaks, you know, I would open up the tree book and I would start taking notes. And, you know, looking back at my life, I bet everybody can do this. I'm sure everybody can do this, but we just don't think of it. The universe was pushing me all along. You know, there were certain spirits, shall we say, that were that had plans that I was not aware of. And so I wrote the book while I was a grad student, you know, so in my spare time. And then Phoenix Publishing, which no longer exists, Doug Brown did a beautiful job. He published it, and you know, it's become a classic. It's kind of a classic, and a lot of people have it, but it's been out of print. It was out of print for over a decade.
And yeah, I have it. Doesn't it have a yellow cover?
Yeah, that's the original one.
Yeah,
it goes for like $70 now on on Amazon. but then I, you know, I obviously I've been around the block a few times since that book came out, and so I found Pendrag Publishing, and they're in California, and they accepted the task of, you know, doing this new version. So this version is expanded. It has full color pictures. It has a lot of recipes, a lot more recipes than the other book did. And by I mean actually, you know, how to make wine out of oak leaves, you know, things like that. A lot of recipes in there. And the illustrations are gorgeous because they're full color. The cover is different. You know, it's a blue cover this time with a tree. And it's I'm just very happy with the way it came out.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And it is, if you go on Amazon, I know. And now on your website, do you have where they can actually buy the book? Do you have a bookstore on your website?
Yeah, I have a bookstore. People can order it from me. If they order it from me, they get a signed copy, and they get a personal note from me in there. So if you do order it, please, when you pay by PayPal, please put a note on who you want it autographed to, because people buy them for gifts, for example. You know, you might want to give it to somebody else, so just tell me who you want it signed to. And then you get a first edition signed by the author.
That's really cool. In fact, I may have to do that. My partner is a book collector, so, and you're right, he loves first editions and he loves them signed. So that would be, you know, it's never too early to start shopping for Yule.
That's right. Only 10 months till Christmas.
I know, isn't that the truth? Well, you were very gracious to send me some updates, and you sent me a copy of the book, The Real Witches of New England, and I have to say it looked very inviting. Tell me about that.
Wait, did I send you the whole book or just the cover?
No, you sent me a copy of the cover. So
oh.
It looked very intriguing. So
yeah, because that book's not out yet.
Yeah, so tell me
about
that
book. Yeah, the Real Witches of New England will be coming out in September, and the idea is to launch it right at Samhain, you know, right
uh-huh.
when the Halloween thing is happening. Well, what happened was I went to a poetry reading, and
mm-hmm.
this poet, Michael Mowry, was reading a poem about twice-dead Mary, who was a witch, who I had never heard of. I mean, I've lived here in this area of Massachusetts for 30 years, and she's literally buried 17 minutes from my house because I
You're
timed
kidding.
It. I had
yeah.
no clue. I had no idea. You know, I was thinking about Salem. Everybody mm-hmm. talks about Salem, and Salem is near Boston, and that's 2 hours away, and nobody in Western Massachusetts thinks about Salem. We don't care about Salem. It's not, you know, it's kind of a historical thing, but we're just not that
right.
involved with Salem. And then I was shocked to find out that here was this woman, and she was one of the original persecuted witches, and the reason she's called Twice Dead Mary is because she was hung, but she didn't die. And she literally hung for like 12 hours. And
oh, wow.
Right, and then they cut her down, and she wasn't dead. She was still alive. And they threw her into a snowbank because they were so disgusted, and they left her there. And she lived for, I think, 10 or 12 years after that.
Oh, my gosh.
yeah, I mean, and then I started finding out, you know, there was another witch in, not too far from me in another town, maybe 20 minutes from here, there was another one.
Mm-hmm.
And I started looking into it, and I said, holy cow. Because, you know, I'm a druid, and I just don't think that much about witches. I mean, some
mm-hmm.
of my best friends are witches, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I like witches, but I just, it wasn't, you know, all my books are druidic books, or have been up until now. And I all of a sudden, I was realizing that here were these women. So I went to Twice Dead Mary's, I tried to find her grave. I went to the graveyard
mm-hmm.
where she's buried, and I couldn't find her grave. But there were some gravestones that were smashed that people had chipped off the front so you couldn't tell who was buried there. And I suspect
uh-huh.
that probably one of those was hers. So what I did was I brought a rose, and there's this huge oak tree in the middle of the graveyard. So I put the rose
mm-hmm.
at the base of the oak, and I asked the spirit of the oak, I said, look, you know who's here. I said, please tell Mary this is for her, and I left the rose there. And then I started writing the book.
That,
so,
you know, and that's so funny. I have never, ever heard Dead Mary.
Right. I'd never heard of her, and I've been living here for 30 years, you know. And, I mean, it's just everybody thinks about Salem, and Salem was actually
yeah.
the very tail end of it. There were over 300 persecuted witches in New England. And
really?
Salem was the last straw. That was when everybody said, this is horrible, we can't do this anymore. It was kind of like people were so ashamed of themselves
mm-hmm.
after Salem, because they finally dawned on them that the people that they had just killed were all Christians, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the descendants of the Salem so-called witches are very adamant about that, you know. None of their relatives were witches as far as they know. And
right.
as far as the only witch that I can identify was Tituba, and she was the only one that wasn't killed. So,
is it? Exactly.
So,
what research I've done, I think it, wasn't about spirituality. It was much about property rights and gaining people's property.
That was part of it. It was also misogyny.
Mm-hmm.
They hated women, especially old
right.
women. They were scared of them, and they hated them. And poor old women. If you were poor, old,
mm-hmm.
and female, you were basically toast. That's the magical formula.
Yes.
Because your younger relatives, probably your younger male relatives, would want access to your property. They wouldn't want to take care of you in your old age because that would be an expense, and
mm-hmm.
they'd have all that. I mean, that the most dangerous thing to be in this country was to be an old woman who was a widow, no man to protect her. That was like the most dangerous thing you could be.
Right, and something like the flu or some type of illness goes to the village, and then you just automatically got blamed.
Right, they would blame the old woman. They would identify.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were men who were persecuted as well, but it was mostly women. Yeah. And I don't want to give away too much, but what I did was I investigated. Obviously I couldn't tell the stories of all the 300 plus witches that were persecuted, but I picked some of the more interesting ones. And I tried to find ones in every New England state. So I have Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
Massachusetts, Connecticut,
Same.
And I tell their stories, but I also have a history, a timeline of the witch persecutions starting in the Bronze Age, because that's as far back as I could go, the
mm-hmm.
Old Testament. And then going through Europe. And it's not what a lot of people say, 9 million witches. It wasn't 9 million witches.
Mm-hmm.
Probably closer to 60,000 maybe
mm-hmm.
in Europe, but only 300
That's still
here.
A horrific number. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the technique was that you would persecute one person in a given area, and that was enough to terrify everybody. You didn't have to kill a whole
mm-hmm.
lot of people. If you just brutally murder one person, the word kind of gets out. So anyway, I have this timeline from the Bronze Age to the present.
Mm-hmm.
And then I talk about the New England witches. And then I interviewed the real witches of New England, the ones that are alive now, and, people that I know and people
mm-hmm.
that were recommended to me from different witch traditions. So
mm-hmm.
the arc of the book is everything from the Bronze Age to the present.
That's really fun. And it's funny, as you're talking, I'm so used to, as you say, Salem and Massachusetts. And the idea of a story of a Maine witch never entered my head. So that's...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I have
stories about Maine witches and Springfield, Massachusetts. I think the very first witch persecution. Well, I hear different. Some people say Springfield, Massachusetts. Some people say
mm-hmm.
Connecticut. But I think it was Springfield, Massachusetts, which is in western Massachusetts, which nobody ever thinks about, But the politics were so interesting because in Boston, you had these educated lawyers, and they kind of thought the whole thing was ridiculous. So
mm-hmm.
the western Massachusetts rural people would capture a witch, somebody that they thought was a witch, and they would drag her to Boston to be tried, and then the lawyers in Boston would just say, this is ludicrous, and send her back. And sometimes the same woman would go back and forth like several times because the town was trying so hard to get rid of her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the nice part is that they did come to their senses. In Europe, it took centuries for them to calm down, And here it happened pretty quickly.
How long was the witch wars? They're like 200 or 300 years. How long were they? It was a long, long time.
Well, like I said, it started in the Bronze Age.
Yeah.
And, but it actually... witches weren't really persecuted that badly until around the 12th century.
Mm-hmm.
That's when it got really bad. people were pretty tolerant until then. And then it's hard to figure out exactly what it was, but it had to do with the church consolidating its power. And you
mm-hmm.
know, the way you consolidate your power is by terrifying everybody. And
mm-hmm.
you know, once the church felt powerful, it took about 1,000 years to convert most Europeans, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And even to this day, if you travel in Ireland, you know, the good Irish Catholics are still building their bonfires on the hillsides, and they're still going to the holy wells because there's a magical trout that appears every year to bless the water, you know, things like
that. Right.
It's
interwoven, and yes.
Pardon?
I say it's just interwoven into their spirituality.
Yeah, it's still there. It hasn't completely gone away. Yeah. But around the 12th century was when the church really got the upper hand, and they felt very powerful. And, you know, and then they just started bullying people, I guess you would say, and it just got worse and worse and worse.
So you talked earlier. Go ahead. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I just said, that's okay, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I know you started writing very early, and I know you mentioned that you were Druid. Tell me how you came to that path. Did you grow up as a Druid? How did you become a Druid?
Well, I was born in Austria, and
mm-hmm.
My mother was very interested in the archaeology, the
mm-hmm.
ancient, the graves that were being dug up, and the weapons and the jewelry and the bones that were being found and the ironwork and all that. She was just really into it. So she would talk to me about the Celts, and she had just incredible respect and reverence, you know, for the ancient Celts. So I grew up with that, and I didn't think anything of it. And it wasn't until I was in my 30s when I was living in America, because I was born in Austria, but I came here. And I, like I said, I was living in Philadelphia, and I heard Celtic music for the first time. I just remember I turned on the radio, and there was this music, and it just blew me away. I couldn't believe it, you know. And then after that, I became a Cayley dancer. I used to, every Friday night, I was at the Irish Club, and always going to the Irish music festivals, and I was just totally into it, you know. And then I was an herbalist, and I had my own practice. And
mm-hmm.
one day, one of my clients came, and I was taking her case, and she mentioned that she was the seamstress for the Flying Karamazov brothers. I think that's who they were. She
mm-hmm.
was their seamstress, and she told me she had just met a Druid, and. It's the weirdest thing, but the minute I heard the word Druid, she said the word Druid out loud, and
uh-huh.
I never heard that word. Okay, this is in the 1980s, right?
Right.
The minute I heard that word, it was like this bell or this harp string kind of, you know, ding, literally,
mm-hmm.
inside of me. And then I asked, I said, what do you mean you met a Druid? What's a Druid? You know, and it was Isaac Bonowitz. She had met
uh-huh.
Isaac at a festival, and she was talking about his white robes, his beautiful, clean white robes, and she was so impressed
uh-huh.
with how intelligent he was, and he was so smart and all this stuff. And I just, it's like from then on, I knew that's what I was. I had never met a Druid, didn't know what a Druid was, you know, but I spent the next few years trying to find Druids, and I did, and I was actually one of the first members of ADF. There were only 30 members at the
uh-huh.
time, yeah. So the rest is history.
There you go, and I know that you're currently the Archdruid of the Tribe of the Oak. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, there's this progression. I was a member of ADF, and then I became an initiate. I did my second circle. Then I co-founded the Henge of Keltria,
mm-hmm.
and I was vice president of that for 9 years. And then I co-founded the Order of White Oak, and I was co-chief
mm-hmm.
there for 5 years. And then White Oak kind of, I don't know how to put it. We created a training program, and then everything just kind of slowed down. And I said, we really need a teaching group, you know, a group that is just for teaching people about Druidism. And so then I created the Tribe of the Oak, and I'm very, very pleased. We have a website, tribeoftheoak.com. It's a teaching grove for people who want to become initiates, and it's very thorough druidic training. We have a beautiful collection of early Irish poetry, stories, manuscripts. We have a basic reading list, which is on the website, tribeoftheoak.com, and you can go there, and you have to read all the books first, then you go through the training program. But the core of it is we have this collection of 7th century, which is about as old as you can get, Irish, very Irish-based writings. Because the way, I mean, I helped create the original White Oak teaching program, but the way we all thought of it when we created it was we wanted the oldest material that we could get our hands on, because that was as close as possible to the old, ancient Druids, you know, what they were teaching. So, and there's quite a lot out there. There, you know, a lot of the British-oriented orders, they always say, oh, we don't know anything about the ancient Druids, but it's not true. If you focus on the Irish material, we have quite a lot of stuff, wisdom teachings, and but you have to have that in your soul. You have to have that in your heart. You have to really want to know the old Celtic material.
So I think that's really innovative, though. So basically, because that's something that I do hear in my travels as I speak, is that if you live in a metropolitan city or you live somewhere where there's lots of different traditions or there's lots of different pagans, it's really easy. But if you live in an area where there's not a lot of diversity or no one, then you kind of don't have anything. So that really kind of sounds like it fills that need.
Yeah, well, we are online. We have an online teaching program. But we do meet in the summer. We have a Lunasa camp. I guess witches would call it Lamas. We call it Lunasa. That's about as face-to-face as we can get. I mean, there are some people who come out here, you know, other times. But in general, we just have this one camp. And the rest of the time, we have a Facebook page. It's not public, so you can't find it. once you sign up and you're part of the teaching program, then I admit you to the Facebook page. But we actually have two Facebook pages now. One is kind of like outer court, one is inner court, you know, for people studying. It's just beautiful. If you really want to learn the Irish Celtic material, it's a beautiful, beautiful program, I think. So,
now, a book that I'm interested in, because I saw it, and I don't think I have, Secret Medicines from Your Garden. Tell me a little bit that, because I know that I have a book that you, that Making Kitchen Medicines. Tell our listeners what that is, what the premise of that is.
Secret Medicines from Your Kitchen is a small book. Secret Medicines from Your Garden is a big book. It's about wildcrafting. So it's divided into the seasons, you know, things you can find in the spring, in the summer, in the fall, in the winter. A lot of my personal journey, you know, I've spent time studying with Native American elders. I've had different spiritual experiences with plants, with trees, with the elders. That's all in there. Stories. So it's kind of, someone said it's a combination memoir and herbal. And then in the back of the book, I have this beautiful formula-making system that I was taught. My teacher was William LeSassier, who is very well-known to people who, you know, people who study herbalism know William. But He's no longer with us. But anyway, I was one of his students, and he taught us this gorgeous formula-making system that was revealed to him by Pythagoras. This is, and other people look at it and they say, oh, that's very druidic because it's mm-hmm. all based on threes. But his story was he was lying on the couch one day and he was having a fight with his wife, and his wife was uh-huh. yelling at him. And while she was screaming, he was trying to block it out, and all of a sudden Pythagoras, the philosopher, mathematician, right. Pythagoras, appeared to him and gave him this triangle system of formula making, and he wrote it down, and it works incredibly well. It's beautiful. But what's really interesting, I mean, I'm a druid, and uh-huh. there was a druid named Abaris who spent time with Pythagoras, and we know uh-huh. this. This is a historical fact. What we don't know is, was Abaris the teacher of Pythagoras, or did Pythagoras teach Abaris? We don't know. So there's a druidic connection, because druids look at this triangle system. You know, Greek people look at the triangle system. Oh, yeah, it's mm-hmm. Pythagoras, it's triangles. But a druid looks at it, and, you know, for druids, the number three is very sacred. You know, our deities are triple. We have the three mm-hmm. worlds. And here's this herbal system based on threes, you know. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's in the back of the book, and I have long lists of herbs and where they fit in the formula-making system. And I hope that made sense, because you have to kind of see it. I take you through it step by step, you know, very carefully, one page at a time. You can study it, and it does work beautifully.
Well, and you have, I've got most of your books. I think you've written now it sounds like you've written almost 15 books, but they've all, up until you wrote the Priests of the Forest, they had all been nonfiction books.
Right.
Correct? So tell me, what got you thinking about writing nonfiction?
Well, you know, I've always been a teacher. You know, I've been mm-hmm. teaching herbalism since 1983, and I've been teaching druidism since 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, the idea was to create novels that would have the druid path in them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the covers, the first one, Priestess of the Forest, is green. The second one, the Druid Isle, is blue. And the third one, mm-hmm. Priestess of the Fire Temple, is red. So
red.
The first one is about sacred land. The second one is about the realm of sea, sacred water. The third one is about fire and the realm of sky. And those are the three worlds. Those are the druidic three worlds. And within the books, I mean, they are stories, you know,
mm-hmm.
But within each book is the druid path, the festivals, the prayers, the tools, and the correct old Irish terms for everything. There's a glossary, pronunciation guide, and the old Irish terms in each book. And I had a wonderful scholar, Alexei Kondratiev, who helped me with that. Mm-hmm. He was a linguist, and...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so my idea was, I think this is why I came to this planet. I think this is my mission. My mission was just to keep the old ways alive and keep them going. So people who read these novels can learn the old Irish correct terms for all the druidical, the philosophical ideas, the tools, you know, all kinds of things, foods, you name it. It, you know, we have the terms in there, and you can pronounce them sort of correctly, and just keep the whole tradition alive and keep it going. That's the idea. And because not everybody wants to be a scholar, you know.
Mm-hmm.
To be a druid initiate, you really have to do a lot of reading. You study.
Mm-hmm.
It's like being any kind of a priest or priestess. Mm-hmm. You really have to know the material, you know. But some
mm-hmm.
people just don't want to read the archaeology and the anthropology and the,
mm-hmm.
you know, they'd rather just read a novel. But what's happening now, I do have a website, and it's Patreon, patreon.com/ Ellen E. Hopman. If you go there, you can see little clips. I have a beautiful actress, Elise Poppers, who's the real deal. I mean, she's been in actual Hollywood movies, and she's like the real thing. And she will play the lead if we can get this together. And James Myers, who has Buccaneer Pictures, he's in California, is reworking. We did have a script. He's now reworking the script. He's hoping to do a little short, you know, make a little teaser, so for fundraising purposes and to kind of get the word out. I'm going to be going to Ireland in May and hopefully meeting with people over there to talk about the project. And who knows? It's a long shot, but it would be very nice if it happened.
So will it focus on one book? Or tell me about, because I've read your nonfiction. I have not read your fiction yet. But now you've gotten me excited. I definitely want to read it. So is it the same person through each story, or is it different time periods? What time period does Creases of Force start at?
Okay, it goes from 2nd century to 5th century.
Okay.
The three books go from 2nd century to 5th century. So the 2nd century is when the very first missionaries were showing up in Ireland. And the first missionaries were coming actually from Gaul, which is what we call France now. And that's all historical. I mean, that's where they came from. The whole Patrick myth, that really is a myth. I mean, there were several Patricks, and anyway, but in the 2nd century is when it started. So it's written from the point of view of the Druids when the very first missionary shows up in this community and you know, how they interact. And, you know, the Celtic religion, if you study it, and the Celtic culture, it wasn't totally egalitarian, but women were very powerful, and women had a lot of rights. Women had rights of divorce, rights of inheritance, you know, things that we lost when the Roman Christian church came in. We lost all of that, and we still haven't gotten it all back. You know, it's like we're still trying to get our status back. But so here are these female druids, you know, they're male druids in there also, and there's warriors and there's battles and all that stuff. But the female, each book has very strong female characters, and so they have to try to adjust to this new philosophy that's coming in. And then the second book, The Druid Isle, takes you to a real place. It's an island off the coast of Scotland that really exists, and I've been there. And in the Iron Age, there was a fort on the island. And anyway, it was considered a very, very sacred place. It was called the Isle of Yew, or the Isle of Druids. And these days it's called Iona, if people have heard of it. And Columba, who was the priest monk who converted Scotland, he used Iona as the launching pad from which to proselytize Scotland, and I think that was very deliberate, because the church had an official policy that if you identify a sacred place, you plop a church on top of it, you know?
Absolutely.
Or if you identify... Sorry?
I said, because people are going there anyway to worship. And
right,
to,
people are going there. They're used to going there.
Yeah.
And if you know that they're worshiping a god or a goddess, say, at a particular well, then you just rename the well, you know.
Right.
So anyway, so I think he very deliberately went to Iona because that was considered the holiest island of the Druids. And he went there and, you know, put his Christian community there. Anyway, so that's the second book. It takes you to Iona before the Christians got there, when the Druids were still there, when there was a Druid school. And you go through all the different initiations at the Druid school. And then the third book, Priestess of the Fire Temple, that takes place in the 5th century. So obviously in the first two books, the same characters go through the first two books. But by the third book, it's now the 5th century, and they're all dead except one of them does magically reappear. And now we go back to Ireland, and you know Newgrange in Ireland? Have you heard of Newgrange? Yeah.
No.
So it's this amazing temple on the Boyne River, and the action is centered around Newgrange. And, I mean, I've been to Newgrange several times now, and I have my own ideas about what happened there and what people did there. So that's in the third book.
Well, that sounds fun. Now, was it difficult going from writing nonfiction and doing that type of research to coming up with stories? And isn't there some romance in some of these in your books also?
Oh, yeah, there's plenty. Yeah, you got to have sex and you got to have violence.
I hope to take sex and make... Anyway, I...
well, I mean, it was very hard because I was tying myself in knots trying to figure out how to do it. Because, again, I have no instruction. Nobody ever... I never was part of a writing group. I had no idea what to do. But then what happened was... I was, you know, tearing my hair out trying to create an outline for the first book because I started reading all these articles, how to write a novel, you know. It's a, well, you have to start with the outline, you know, and so I sat there and I wrote an outline. And then, but what happened was, and this happened with all three books, by the third book I had calmed down and I wasn't so worried, but I would start with the outline, and as soon as I sat down, it was like I went into a trance, and it's called the writer's trance. There's an actual term for it. And it's, you know, people say, oh, you're channeling. But any real novelist, I found out, this is what happens. It's like you think you have an idea of where the story's going. You think you know what the characters are going to do. But the characters take over. They have their own minds. Their own opinions, they have their own actions, and you can't control it. You know, all you can do is just follow them around and record what they're doing. So that's what would happen. I would sit and literally, you know, within minutes I would be in this writer's trance, and I would be seeing the characters doing things that I had never thought of, saying things I had never thought of that I never knew. They were showing me rituals, you know, they were doing all kinds of things. So all I did was follow them around, basically.
That is really interesting. I had never heard that before. That is really, really interesting. I have heard writers and I've interviewed authors who've said the book didn't turn out like I first imagined it. And I've heard that life of its own, but I've never heard of writer's trance before. That's really interesting.
Yeah, the books just took off, and you know, I had no idea how it was going to end. Just not, I didn't have a clue, you know. But, yeah, a writing teacher, I did finally talk to a woman who's a writing teacher, and she said, oh, she said, that's what real novelists experience. That's the experience. So.
Did you enjoy the process? Do you like
it? Yeah, oh, yeah, it's like being on a shamanic journey. You know, the first one, it took me 9 years because, like I said, I was trying so hard to come up with this outline of this, you know, story. And then when I finally sat down to write it, it probably took about 2 years. And then the second one took about 2 years, and then the third one just took a year.
Wow. And,
but, it, you know, and then by the end of the process, by the end of the 2 years or the end of the year, I was totally exhausted because it was like being on a shamanic journey. Because, I mean, I was working. I had a job. I was teaching Druidism. I was teaching herbalism. I had a regular part-time day job. And I was writing these books. And but it's better now because now I'm finally, quote-unquote, retired, which means that I write 7 days a week. That's what I'm doing now. So,
Oh, that's fun. And it's fun. Did you ever think there, as you were writing this, that there would be a possibility of a movie?
Well, I still don't know if that's going to happen.
I don't know. I think it sounds fun. So,
yeah, well, of course, but everybody thinks that, you know.
Yeah.
Every person who writes fiction thinks that. But you have to find a producer. That's what I'm finding out. The hardest part is finding a producer. That's the money person.
Right.
Because you need a lot of money. Everything else is easy. Actors, actresses, you know, locations, that's all easy.
You just need somebody who will have faith to finance.
Right, the financing, because we could get Celtic reenactors who have costumes, who have weapons, you know, all that is, that's all easy. The hard part is finding somebody who has, you know, $1 million or something.
Absolutely.
You wouldn't believe how much money it takes.
Really?
$1 million is nothing. Yeah, $1 million is a drop in the bucket. Yeah, really.
It sounds like you've learned a lot through this process.
Oh, I have. Trust me, I have. But if that's what the gods have in mind, it'll happen. But anyway, if people want to help out with this, like I said, the site is called Patreon, patreon.com/Ellen E. Hopman, and you can go there and you can become a patron. And if we can get a bunch of patrons, that would be great because. We need to film a short. That's the next step. Yeah. We need to get a short done that can be taken to festivals and used for fundraising. So any druids out there with, and you can give, you know, $3 a month, you can give $10 a month, you can give $50 a month, you know, whatever you want to do. And there's different little perks that you get depending on what you give, so.
Oh, that's good luck, and I'm going to send energy because I think that would be, I think it sounds like a fabulous movie, and actually, to be honest, I'm going to try to get the books. It sounds like they're really, really, I mean, it sounds like they're really fun books to read. Is there any other, do you have any thoughts, since you're a prolific writer, of a new fiction series?
Well, I'm going to Ireland in May. I'm going to be there for almost a month. So I'm hoping, I mean, typically with what happens is I'll go to Ireland or Scotland and I'll visit the ancient sites and then I call it feeling into a site. You know, I go there and I just hang out with the stones and I hang out with the land and gradually I kind of get messages. I get, you know, visions and messages and you know, something will emerge from that. But there is one more thing I wanted to mention in case anybody from New England is listening. Coming up in July 14th and 15th in Vermont, I'm going to be teaching the Om alphabet, which is the pre-Christian Irish alphabet. And the Om alphabet has all tree names. So willow, oak, you know, holly, those are the names of the letters of the alphabet. And I'm going to be teaching lore, medicine, and the alphabet of the trees, the lore of the trees of the alphabet. If people are interested in that, they can go to greenmountaindruidorder.org. That's all one word, greenmountaindruidorder.org. And it's in July in Vermont, and Vermont is beautiful. So if you want to take a road trip and go to Vermont.
I've never been to Vermont. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, Vermont is very rural, very untouched, you know. The Green Mountains are just exquisite, wild.
So to attend this class, do you need to have prerequisite information? Do you need to be a druid? What do you need to have?
Well, you should pre-register. Just go to greenmountaindruidorder.org, and then she has a calendar page, and if you scroll down, it's called Tree Divination Using the Ancient Celtic Om Alphabet. July 14 and 15. And you can camp on the land there, or there are B&Bs and things like that, but you can camp if you want. So that
all
should
right.
be great.
That
and then if people
fun.
If people want to study Druidism, they can go to tribeoftheoak.com.
I think that sounds exciting. What are there any myths or misinformation that you think folks have about Druids?
Oh, there's tons. For one thing, most people don't know anything about Druids. The general public.
I was going to say, but one thing I had thought is that I thought that it was actually something that wasn't very prevalent. And almost every festival or every event I go to, I will meet someone who will introduce themselves as Druid to me. So I have found, and that's been recent for me in the last 5 years.
Well, okay, I just want to say in the general culture, no, people don't know about Druids. You know,
absolutely.
Everybody's heard of witches, and,
right.
but nobody's heard about Druids in the general culture. Mm-hmm. In the pagan culture, many years ago, Green Egg did a survey, and I wish somebody would do a survey now, but back then, 98% of pagans considered themselves Wiccan
mm-hmm.
or pagan. And the 2% that was left was everybody else, and that included Druids, you know, Egyptian paganism.
Right.
Greek, you know. So there's very few Druids compared to Wiccans or witches to begin with. And then often, even in pagan situations, people will say to me, oh, I thought Druids were all men. And, you know, I have an article that's on the internet that you can find. It's called Female Druids or the Evidence
mm-hmm.
for Female Druids. You can Google it. And there were many female druids, famous female druids who were poets, female druids who were seers, who were prophets, you know, they prophesied. And I actually have their names, you know. it's something that, again, because of the church, you know, the church focuses on male figures and scholars tend to focus on male figures. So
right.
the female druid has been almost erased, you know, from history and from memory. So I guess that's part of my mission has been to keep that idea going. Just like in the Celtic society, women had a lot of status compared to what happened later when the church came in. Female
right.
druids, you know, because druids were a caste. It was a caste system, just like in India. It's the same
mm-hmm.
culture as India, actually. And most druids were trained in their family. They were trained by their parents. So they were trained by both their mother and their father.
Hmm.
Yeah.
See, I didn't know that. I'm thinking, because I know women who identify and who are druids. But you are absolutely right. When I think of ancient druids, I only think of men. Isn't that interesting?
Right,
I never
you think of a man with a beard.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And white robes
yep.
in a circle. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yep.
Ellen, I feel another book coming along. Anyway.
But, yeah, if you read the novels, I very consciously wanted the main characters to be strong female druids because
mm-hmm.
I wanted to get that idea out there, you know.
All right. Well, thank you so much. You were a delightful guest, and I really want to thank you for taking time out to be with us tonight.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I really appreciate it. And it's almost spring here, which is nice.
Absolutely. And I look forward so. Tell us again your website. They can go and get an autographed copy of your book. Is
Ellen, Ellen Evert, Evert, Hopman, H-O-P as in Paul, M-A-N, .com, EllenEverettHopman.com. And you'll see all my books there, and then you can you'll also find links for the Tribe of the Oak. And I have a monthly blog. If you're into archaeology, I have a monthly blog. I talk about herbalism and archaeology every month. So.
And if you're in Vermont in July, give us that website again also.
Green Mountain Druid Order, all one word, .org.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And I don't want to wait another 2 years before I get to talk to you again. And I will definitely have to get your fiction series and read it. And maybe we'll come back on and we'll talk about it. Because, it sounds real intriguing. And I'm a big fiction and I like series. So I will talk to you about it. And I'll probably have lots of questions after I read it.
Wonderful. I look forward to it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye, hon. Besides Ellen, I'd also like to thank David, our sound engineer, for his technical expertise. And finally, I'd like to thank all of you out there, our listeners, for your continued support of all of our shows here on Circle Radio. We'll now transition the end of our show with a musical selection. Good night, everyone, and blessed be.
Omanana, God of the sea, stolen and replaced by the cross. Thou shalt have no false gods before me. Oh, Manana, Manana, the clear. So sad to see you gone, but even sadder still to see this hate and fear. Oh, I say believe what you want to believe, whether that would be one god, a pantheon, or winged fairies. Is your own sacred song. Live and let live, do as thou will, and harm none. Oh, Manana, God of the sea, stolen and replaced by the cross of a thou shalt have no false gods before me. Oh, Manana, Manana, the clear. So sad to see you gone, but even sadder still to see this hate and fear. They seek as you desire, whether that be book or candle, vision, earth, air, water, or fire. Be kind, compassionate friend, do unto the other as the other would have you do unto them. Oh, Manana, God of the sea, stolen and replaced by the cross of a thou shalt. No false gods before me. Oh, Manana, Manana, the clear. So sad to see you gone, but even sadder still to see this hate and fear.
Sure. Oh,
Manana,
oh, Manana,
God of
Thank you for joining us on the Circle Sanctuary Network podcasts, presented by Circle Sanctuary and produced for all who follow the Nature Center paths. Join us here throughout the week for various programming connecting the community around the world. And please don't forget to watch for updates on the Circle Sanctuary website at www.circlesanctuary.org. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CSNpodcasts. We can also be found on your favorite podcast hosting sites, such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and others. And until next time, many blessings.